from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
A blurry photo of a letter ends with the resignation of a Vatican official in what is being called Pope Francis's Lettergate. We will hear all the details from Father Raymond D'Souza. Plus, we find out what converts and cradle Catholics have in common from Katrina Fernandez, right here on Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, and I'm joined by Matthew Bunsen. Matthew, welcome.
Great to be with you, as always.
So Pope Francis marked his fifth anniversary on March 13th, but the focus of media was on a letter written by his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, and what the Vatican revealed about the letter, but what it also failed to reveal. We're joined now by Register contributor Father Raymond D'Souza. Father Raymond, welcome.
Thank you, Jeanette. Good to be on. Matthew, hello.
So you just wrote an analysis of this situation, but before we jump into your very well-written commentary, let's talk a little bit about the facts of what happened, what is being called Lettergate. I think Edward Penton, our colleague, coined that term. But Father D'Souza, describe the events that have happened over the last week.
Well, it's a little hard to believe, actually, but basically what happened was the Vatican Publishing House put out 11 small books or booklets to mark the fifth anniversary of the Holy Father, and it's called The Theology of Pope Francis. It was meant to sort of say, look, this is how he thinks, and really in the background was an attempt to say, you know, he's got a profound theological vision. Because most people say, you know, his real strengths are that he's a pastor, mm-hmm. right? He's close to the people, and maybe they imply by that he doesn't have a theological depth. So this was a kind of a project to illustrate that. They asked 11 different people to write these little books. And in January, the head of the Vatican Communication, his name is Monsignor Vigano, wrote to Pope Benedict, said, these books are coming out in a couple of months. Here's a copy. Would you like to write a little bit of a page or two for the occasion? And that would, you know, boost the profile of the books. And probably what Monsignor Vigano hoped was that Pope Benedict would write something saying, you know, that Pope Francis is a man with profound theological vision. We don't know what letter Monsignor Vigano sent to Pope Benedict. Edward Penton, our colleague, has asked for it, but that's not been released. Anyway, Pope Benedict wrote back to Monsignor Vigano in February and said, look, you know, it's a bit stupid, he said, he used a strong word, for people to think that, you know, Pope Francis is only a pastor with no theological vision, and I was only a theologian with no closeness to the people. So that's a stupid prejudice. And then he said, so maybe this initiative will help that, and will show the interior continuity between the pontificates. But, you know, by the way, I'm not going to read the books. I haven't read them. I don't intend to read them. I've got other things to do. And I'm not going to comment on something I haven't read. And then he said, and by the way, one of the contributors here, I'm quite surprised to find, because he actually was very hostile to my magisterial teaching and that of John Paul II. So I'm surprised to see him here. And for this reason, I'm sure you'll understand why I'm not going to answer your request.
Of course.
That letter was sent to Monsignor Vigano, private and confidential. That's what it was sent.
Right. But it didn't end up that way.
Well, quite to the... If only it had.
Right.
If only it had. And Monsignor Vigano, more than most, would hope now. But for whatever reason, at the press conference releasing these books, Monsignor Vigano said, we have a beautiful letter from Pope Benedict, and it says that it's a stupid prejudice to contrast these two pontificates, one intellectual and one pastoral. There's an interior continuity between them, and he applauds this initiative. Okay.
And that's it.
Then he also said, and by the way, he can't read, he's not going to write an assessment simply because he doesn't have these other commitments. So he read that. Then the problems began, because what actually happened was, although he said that second part at the press conference, the picture the Vatican released of the books with Benedict's letter had blurred out the lines which said, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to write the contribution you asked for. So even though he read it, the picture that went out obscured it.
Right.
The Associated Press said, hold on a second, what's going on here? And then they said, well, we digitally altered the photograph. And today that's actually a very serious breach of journalistic ethics because it's so easy to Photoshop things, to digitally alter things. It's considered if you put out a photograph as a news agency, it can't be altered.
Right.
That's a basic rule. And the Vatican communications shop should not have done that. They were called on that. And then Monsignor Brigano said, okay, sorry, made a mistake. Here's what that paragraph read, which was the one about the, I can't do it for reasons of health and other commitments. I'm not that interested, whatever. He did not reveal that last paragraph, which said that there was a problem with one of the contributors. This contributor was hostile to Benedict, that Benedict thought it was odd. He said surprised, meaning that he was offended that this person had been chosen. And for that reason, he wasn't going to participate in that. That was kept entirely out of the photograph and nothing at the press conference.
Right.
As all the sort of kerfuffle grew, eventually it leaked out. It could have been. Someone close to Benedict said, look, by the way, this is not actually what he wrote. All of it was released on Saturday, and that exposed that this private and confidential letter was released in part by Monsignor Brigano to give an impression that the Pope Emeritus had not given, namely that he supported these books, and actually concealed the real reason he refused to contribute because of who was chosen to write these books. So it was a real disaster because, A, what was intended to show that Benedict had thought that Francis was a theologically profound thinker in line with himself actually revealed that someone who wrote the book, not Francis, one of these contributors, Benedict said, is not actually in line with what I thought. That was embarrassing.
Right.
And then, of course, the head of the Vatican Communications had been revealed to manipulate and to deceive. And once that came out on Saturday, apparently, probably on Sunday or Monday, once you figure out what to see the Holy Father, he resigned that day. It's an odd kind of resignation letter, but he resigned. And on Wednesday, it was revealed the Pope accepted the resignation, although...
Let's stop right there. Cliffhanger. Let's get into your analysis. So that is very, a lot has happened with this. Edward Penton has... chronicled it in his blog.
Yeah, he put out a chronology so you could keep track of day
yes.
by day because you had to have a schedule.
It's the top trending item on our website, and it should be read. It's Vatican reveals full text of Benedict the 16th letter to Monsignor Brigano. But you wrote this wonderful analysis, and it's titled Pope Francis's Pontificate Takes Another Hit with Lettergate Mess. And one of the main things that you're putting out there is that this... this deception is quite vivid, and it is actually revealing something, or it's in keeping with other things that have gone on in the culture of this pontificate. And you made some very key points, one of which you mentioned about the theological. Let's say lack of theological confidence in Pope Francis, but there were many other very fine points you made, and maybe the first one was that this resignation is not really a resignation. So let's talk about your analysis.
On that last point, Jeanette, I mean, just to sum it up, so where it stands as of today is that Monsignor Brigano resigned. The Pope accepted his resignation as the head of the Vatican Communications Secretariat, and then in the same letter appointed him to this new role called assessore. That's not a word we usually use in English, assessor, but in Vatican parlance, it usually means the number two, the second or third deputy. So he's resigned as the head of this department, and then he's been appointed to be the number two or three position. Now, the position didn't exist until it was created for him. So it's a very odd resignation because normally when you resign, you go. You don't just go somewhere else in the building. But anyway, the whole thing from start to finish was so bizarre, almost it sort of fits to have a bizarre conclusion. But Monsignor Brigano is not out of the secretariat, but he's not the head of it anymore. When the new, whoever the new prefect is, which has not been decided yet, when he comes in there, he's going to have to figure out, exactly how this is going to work because, the former head of it is going to be down the hall. than the office, presumably, but that'll be complicated. But the analysis I offered was simply that there's been several instances where the accuracy of written texts has been called into question. The one I mentioned, there's the most clear one was when the Pope said at a meeting of priests, I believe it was, he said, you know, the great majority of Catholic marriages are not valid, which created quite a stir, as you could imagine. And instead of saying that I shouldn't have said it, or I was mistaken, or whatever, they just put out the transcript the next day, and when he said the great majority, they just changed it to a portion, which is not what he said. Again, you know, a transcript is either accurate or not. You can always go back and correct what you said, but you can't just pretend you didn't say it. So that was one incident. And then I said, actually, more seriously, in Amoris Laetitiae, a document that has almost 400 footnotes, several of the key footnotes to St. Thomas, Vatican II, St. John Paul, are accurate but truncated in such a way they give a false impression of what was actually being said in the original document. So, you know, I mentioned some of those, there's been a problem here. This is a particularly egregious example, but there has been a problem here with trying to be a little too clever with the manipulation of texts. And in that sense, this example is more dramatic, and it was involved in intentional deception, so it's different. But it's not unprecedented in that, and there's a little bit of that playing loose with the text, and we've seen that over the past few years.
Yeah, Father, are you optimistic at all that this situation is going to change anytime in the near future?
Well, I certainly don't think we're going to have any sort of partial letters being revealed anymore. I mean, this was a pretty unusual consequence. Especially for our American listeners, national politics in the United States has so many resignations and firings, it seems very routine. But actually, it's quite unusual in the Vatican for someone to resign so quickly over something that went wrong. So I think that will be impressed upon other people who might be inclined to make, to try and be a bit too clever, if you want to say. So I would hope. But, you know, I guess, Matthew, the point I made in my analysis was that there has been a little bit of this going along. And, you know, maybe the fact that this didn't work out so well, or in fact, quite to the contrary, worked out so catastrophically, might put an end to it. But
you make a great point in your piece echoing the editorial that we had marking the fifth anniversary of Pope Francis, where you quote Hagan Leo. Making a mess has been a hallmark phrase of Pope Francis.
Which, of course, you clarify wasn't intended to mean do things badly, but it was intended to mean for an evangelical purpose, go and stir things up. And I think the latest examples are not really an example of they're using the word mess in the sense of doing things badly.
Right.
So, Father D'Souza...
Well, it has two meanings, and the Pope said go out there and make a mess, meaning don't always do what you've done before. Don't always make sure everything is absolutely neat and tidy. Take a risk. Be bold in preaching the gospel. And, you know, he gave that speech in Rio de Janeiro in 2013, and I recall I thought it was my favorite thing he had said, because I understand that. I'm a campus minister. You've got to go out there and stir things up. But what I said, this episode, it's not the first time. There's a lot of people have said called it an unforced error. It's a very secondary thing. I mean, presenting flattering books about the Pope is something that should be absolutely routine for the Vatican Publishing House.
Right.
They do it all the time. There's no reason anybody should even pay attention, even when they have press conferences. To make such a horrific scandal out of it, and that, I would say, there's a kind of weariness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking about the fifth anniversary, is that there's been a lot of occasions where some very secondary matter has consumed, you know, several days of media attention. And that's getting tiresome. And, you know, we saw that, you know, most recently and on a very serious issue. And the Holy Father was in Chile and, you know, some of the interviews he gave there. And finally, Cardinal O'Malley of Boston sort of said enough, you know, I've had it with his intervention. Obviously, he didn't use that colloquial language, but that was kind of, what we got there. So I think there's a sort of weariness is that, you know, can we just get through a press conference? Can we just get through a blessing? Can we just get through a flight without any?
Any kind of sideshow, right. Well, Father D'Souza, I'm grateful for you and for Edward Penton staying on your toes and giving us analysis into what is going on, even though sometimes this is on these sort of secondary blunders. It's important to have perspective, and I appreciate the one that you have been providing for us. So thank you.
Good. Well, thank you, Jeanette. And let's hope next week's Holy Week, let's hope we get through Holy Week just talking about Jesus.
Amen. Well, when we come back, we will be joined by Katrina Fernandez to answer the question about converts and cradle Catholics. What do they have in common? This is Register Radio. More when we return.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter. And I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, the Register's Senior Editor. And today we have a special guest. She hasn't been on Register Radio before. Her name is Katrina Fernandez, and she blogs at the Register's site, but also at Alatea, answering questions and giving advice there. And we are talking about converts, because here during Holy Week, we often think about the journey that many are taking into the Church, and it's a wonderful time to think about our own conversions, but also to pray for those who are converting to the Catholic Church. So, Katrina, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You wrote a wonderful blog at the Register called Converts and Cradle Catholics Have Something Special in Common. And we also put that in our print edition because we thought it was so good. And so our print readers will see it there. And so you start with the whole idea that because Easter is upon us, it's a fitting time for us to reflect upon converts. And since you yourself are a convert, I thought we would start first with a little bit about your conversion story.
Well, I converted during Easter Vigil in 2005. It was a long journey. It started out as a Pentecostal, and from there I kind of had a Eucharistic conversion, mm-hmm. just sitting in church one day, and just they were having the symbol celebrating the Eucharist, but as a symbol, so they were inviting people to come up to receive. It was just an oyster cracker and grape juice. But at that moment, I was struck that this was not how it was supposed to be. This was fundamentally wrong. I didn't really have a whole lot of learning at that point, but I just knew that it was wrong. So I got my son, and we got up, and we left.
Wow.
Through some various prodding and some wonderful coincidences in my life, I ended up in Nashville and started going to, like, a mommy group there that happened to meet at a Catholic church, and then just, it was obvious looking back on it now, God just kind of prodded me and pushed me in that direction, and then I ended up back into the Catholic Church.
Well, it's fascinating to, as you stress here, that converts are sometimes a source of envy among cradle or lifelong Catholics. Why is that?
I've heard that cradle Catholics are a little bit envious of converts because we know a lot about faith, not saying that cradle Catholics don't, but their formation was in their youth. So a lot of that information, you know, a lot of that formation that they had growing up in preparation for the sacraments, and you forget that over time. I'll admit that I've forgotten a lot of what I learned in RCIA, you know, 13 years ago. I mean, if you don't keep studying it, it's not fresh. So that's what's appealing to cradles, is the converts are fresh in their knowledge and their appreciation, because it's all new. They're like infants.
I would say.
And it's exciting to them.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I love the sometimes the vigor that I see in new converts. I mean, truly new life, right? Isn't that what conversion
right.
is
it's
all about?
It's almost an infectious enthusiasm, and that's what's so exciting and appealing about converts.
And that's very true.
Now, well, St. Paul comes to mind here.
Right, of course. Of course. I mean, he was like, bang, here I am, and no one believed him because of his past, right? I think that's really true. Talking about converts, I'm a cradle Catholic, and so I can identify with the envy that some have. But as a cradle Catholic, I think I have something unique as well. And you note what is unique about cradle Catholics in your column. Tell us about that.
Well, as a convert, I envy cradle Catholics because you all kind of have this universal experience growing in your faith. And it is very comfortable and natural to you, whereas converts sometimes have to struggle with certain things culturally and spiritually that are foreign to them, and it's like putting on a different skin, whereas you guys it just comes almost so effortlessly, and that could be a source of envy there. When I look at cradle Catholics, they have these unique experiences, like their first communion.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about, oh, they wore the white dress, and that, my first communion as an adult was dramatically different than that, but you guys all have almost the same universal experiences that kind of bond you together.
That is true, and I still remember the date of my first communion and the anticipation
right.
and of standing outside the church. Yeah, I do. I mean, I still do remember that. How do you think, Katrina, that we complement one another, converts and cradle Catholics?
Well, cradle Catholics, because you're so comfortable and just at ease with yourself and your faith, and you don't have the kind of self-consciousness that some converts may have or may experience, you kind of are an example of just living your faith every day, how to incorporate that into your life, whereas converts are still trying to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we can look to cradle Catholics as examples of how to live that every day, how to be comfortable in their Catholic skin.
But you also make the beautiful point that all of us, whether we're cradle Catholics, whether we're converts, are on this journey of learning and conversion. And you write something especially poignant about studying the history of the church and everything about the church, the richness of the Catholic Church and her traditions, that there's almost a lifetime. There is a lifetime that you can spend doing that.
Absolutely. You could spend your entire life studying it and learn something new every day. And that's almost like your call to continual conversion. You can keep it fresh if you constantly study it and keep it before you and study the saints, study the church fathers' readings. You know, every day there's a new insight, and you've also got your life experiences. You know how when you read a book as a kid, like they make you read books in school and you read it and it was horrible, it was boring. And then you go back and read it 10 or 15 years later and you're like, wow, that resonates with you because you have those life experiences to apply to that. It's the same with your faith. And when you read a lot of the church writings and encyclicals, you read them 1 year and then 10 years later, and it just has a whole new meaning and richness for you.
I think that's very true, and actually really picking up on that. Katrina, since you have had a little more freshness than Matthew and myself and probably a good deal of our cradle Catholics, is there anything that you would suggest we do or read, especially in this week of Holy Week, to help keep things fresh?
I would recommend that cradle Catholics stay fresh in the liturgy.
Mm.
And the meaning and the symbolism behind the liturgy, because, and this is something that I've become comfortable with the Mass, that it's even, I'm 13 years in, so, and now it's starting to become regular every
sure.
day. And it is a fight to keep that enthusiasm and that zeal for the faith. So I'd like to study the liturgy and the meaning and the symbolisms behind the Mass so that I'm reminded of the sacrifice that's going on. So it's not just a mundane Sunday trip to church. It is this mystical event that is happening before me every Sunday, and then it helps me appreciate it. And I recommend that for Catholics, cradles, anybody, to know the liturgy like you know your own hand.
Absolutely. Of course, it is the most unique thing we have as Catholics. I mean, Christians have many similar beliefs, but very, very few have the belief in the Eucharist, Christ present to us at the Holy Sacrament of the altar. And, you know, to that point about just focusing on the words that we say, that the words that become so habitual, I spent some time in Italy and I didn't know Italian very well, so I had a Mass booklet that I used every day that I could go to Mass, and I would follow in Italian and in English. And I tell you what, I learned so much about the liturgy and grew so much in my appreciation of the liturgy when I was focused on every single word of the Mass because I didn't understand the language so well. So I completely agree with you. And, you know, as we're about to close here, Katrina, every year at the Easter Vigil, when new converts are coming into the church, my eyes tear up. I mean, I tear up. I get filled with emotion because you are my brother and sister in Christ coming in, and that's such a joyful moment. Tell us just what the convert feels like in that moment.
It is. It's like watching a birth, but it's like watching a new child in Christ and being born. It is a beautiful experience. I remember, you know, the trials and tribulations through RCIA because it's not an easy process to convert. And so I can look at them and I know what they've been through and all the formation that they've gone through. Some people have struggles and it's hard for them to convert because their family might be against it. I used to know a Protestant pastor and he had to give up everything to convert to Catholicism because he was married. He couldn't be a priest. So he just converted. He lost his job. I mean, he literally gave up his life, his livelihood to convert to Catholicism. And you look at those converts and you kind of have an idea of what they've given up or sacrificed mm-hmm. for the Catholic faith, and that just makes it really beautiful, too.
Well, thank you for telling your story. Yes, many converts give up many things, but welcome. Welcome to the church, and welcome to this new life.
It's worth it.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless.